Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bond, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Helbrooks, the Honorable Rachel Bond presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 13th, 2025. We have four cases on our calendar this morning, three oral cases and one non-oral. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we will also be making an audio recording. The audio record of today's hearing should be on the court's website fairly soon. A reminder that no other recordings are permitted without the express permission of the court. With that, I will call the first case, case number A240838, State of Minnesota versus Travis Clay Anderson. As you know, you'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have the opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The podium can be adjusted for your comfort. Before beginning your argument, please identify your name and the party that you represent. Mr. Scanlon, you can proceed when ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Greg Scanlon, and I represent appellant Travis Anderson. We are asking this court to vacate his conviction for threats of violence or to grant him a new trial. I want to say up front that the district court here presided over a great number of Mr. Anderson's cases, and typically was patient and accommodating. He was with Mr. Anderson for a lot of these cases. The charge conduct at issue in this case was one of numerous incidents that all occurred in a single 24-hour period. There were six charges that arose out of that 24-hour period, and those all eventually were tried to a jury. This is the last one that occurred in that 24-hour period. It was the last one charged, and it was the last one tried. Of the six victims, or the six charges in all of those incidents, there were three trials in about a period of 1 month, a year later, and this was the last one. My point is that when the charged incident happened, the jail staff had reached their limit with Mr. Anderson. And our position is that when this trial happened in that month of three trials with six different charges, the district court by that point had reached its limit with Mr. Anderson. One of the questions
So there's no objection in district court that how the court handled the courtroom management issues that arose. Let's just, the numerous outbursts, objections, things that your client did during the trial. There was no objection by defense counsel.
There was not.
So then is it kind of a plain error analysis we apply, or?
I think that's an interesting question because it is the case law on this idea of sort of a perceived bias, we're not saying he was actually biased. We're just talking about how this looked to the jury and what impact it had.
But if it's a plain error analysis, don't you have to prove actual bias?
Well, so that's, I'm looking at Pratt, and Pratt is sort of the first case where they said, well, we're looking at what was, and that is sort of a perceived bias case. It's not about conduct during the trial. But they said, we find that the judge was disqualified, and so we're going to move right to the question of the impact on the fairness and integrity of the courts. There are cases after that where they did sort of put an intermediate step of, we have to find prejudice, and then we look to. But I think the most recent case from the Supreme Court, Malone, and that's State v. Malone 963 Northwest 2nd 453. That's a 2021 case. In that, they say that because the impact on the judicial system and the fairness and integrity, that's one of the three factors that sort of became part of this test for whether there was prejudice, whether there would be a reversal. And what the court says in Malone is that essentially of those three factors, the most important one is the impact on the integrity and the public reputation of the courts. And so that's the one, and that's the only one that they address in that case. And so I do think there was prejudice here. And I can certainly talk about the prejudice. And again, it has mostly to do with the perception on the jury. And you take something like, so even the outburst, when he's saying to Mr. Anderson, "You're not helping yourself, you're not helping yourself." To me, that suggests that what he's doing is evidence in the case. Clearly it's not. Anything he's saying where he's not on a witness stand is not evidence in the case. And if I were an attorney, I would have asked for at least an instruction afterwards saying, "You should disregard everything that Mr. Anderson said. It's not evidence in this case." And the troubling thing about it is that, in a way, even the instruction that the judge, that the standard instruction that the judge gave at the end, didn't tell them that wasn't evidence. The instruction was, "You must consider all the evidence that you have heard and seen in this trial, and must disregard anything you may have heard and seen elsewhere." You could read that and think, well, he's right. This was hurting his case. This outburst, this ranting and screaming out loud about the March 1 incident, was evidence in the case.
But Mr. Was there an instruction either in the preliminary instructions or in the final charge that evidence consists of testimony and exhibits?
Yes, there was. There was. That standard instruction was given. There also was the instruction at the end where the judge, the instruction that says, basically, if you think I did anything that looks like I'm being biased, ignore it, forget it. And so those things were there. And I'm not saying that they weren't.
I assume you were not trial counsel.
I was.
You were.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. In this case?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have been, but I wasn't in this case.
Okay. I just, what I struggle with is courtroom control. You know, reading this transcript, it seemed to me the court was acting appropriately, trying to control this courtroom. I mean, and I didn't really get a sense from your brief, Mr. Scanlon, what you suggest, you know, he did wrong. I mean, without an objection here, with nothing else, and with this appellant who's absolutely unwilling to conform to courtroom procedures, what was the judge to do?
I'm glad you asked. And I have thought about this a lot. And I was at that counsel table a lot myself for my many years as a trial public defender. And I think at that moment, and I realize it's chaos, and as a judge, your head's exploding. So because you're thinking, what do I do? How do I handle this? And I understand the impulse or the instinct or the reaction to sort of talk over and try to tamp it down or try to like overcome it with your own words and stop talking and you're not helping yourself and those sorts of things. I think the best thing to do is the fairest thing to do actually is to get the jury out of the room as quickly as possible, say nothing other than what it takes to get the jury out of the room, let it happen as it happens, and then fix it afterwards. You know, once the jury is gone, you can talk to Mr. Anderson about contempt of court, or I'm going to find that you've waived your right to be present at this trial. And then when the jury comes back, you can talk to them about, ignore all of that. None of that is evidence. We're moving forward. I just think that sort of engagement, that knee-jerk engagement, I think I probably didn't make this clear enough to him. I think if you take any one of these things, you know, telling the state to call the Spriegel witness, sort of what he said about making this outburst evidence, and then the direct interruptions of Mr. I think I'm talking about all of those together. Do I think that any one of them on its own would have been enough? Probably not. Certainly not in terms of prejudice. But again, this is all, the state's evidence has all happened. This is all the last part of the trial. This is their Spriegel witness, it's the outburst, and then it's Mr. Anderson's testimony. And so this is, and again, this is why I say...
And it's closing argument. Didn't your client interrupt the prosecutor's closing argument too?
He did. He interrupted during closing argument. But I don't fault the judge for anything as far as that's concerned. And I'm also not, I'm not trying to say that Mr. Anderson isn't responsible for anything that he did. I mean, you know, if we were here today to decide whether what he did prejudiced his case, you know, we could have an interesting discussion about that. But I like what this court or what our Supreme Court said long ago. This was 75 years ago in Hansen v. St. Paul Rye Company, and this is 231 Min 354 at 361, or 43 Northwest 2nd at 43 Northwest 2nd 260 at 265. The extraordinary prestige of the trial judge creates an extraordinary obligation to refrain from any act, word, sign, gesture, or inflection of voice, the effects of which would be to emphasize a predisposition on the part of the court toward one side or the other. Now, the case that the state is citing for this, for the principle, the analysis about how we look at what a judge does during a trial, making rulings or that sort of thing, is, of course, Leidecke, I think is how you pronounce it, 510 U.S. 540. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1996. And this is their alternative way of how we might view this. And this is what the court there says. The judge who presides at a trial may, upon completion of the evidence, be exceedingly ill-disposed towards the defendant, who has been shown to be a thoroughly reprehensible person. But the judge is not thereby recusable for bias or prejudice, since his knowledge and the opinion it produced were properly and necessarily acquired in the course of the proceedings. My position is the Hansen description is how we address this in Minnesota.
Mr. Scanling, go ahead. Can you just clarify a bit on the sufficiency of the evidence? Your brief says reasonable apprehension element, which an element which goes to the question of whether it's a true threat, is a state of mind. Could you just clarify, is it a reasonable person's state of mind? Is it AS's state of mind? Is it subjective, objective? What's your key position on that question?
So,
and I'd also like to interject. I'd like to know if you are applying a circumstantial or a direct evidence analysis to this issue.
So I do think it's proven circumstantially, and that's because of the idea of apprehension. What one apprehends. And my personal, I don't think this is settled law yet by any means. It might be more settled in this actually comes up as a First Amendment question, right? This is how courts answer the First Amendment question, is this reasonable apprehension that the person will act according to its tenor? I mean, honestly, I'm not even sure it should be an element. But as the current state of the law, it's not plain error. It's in the crim jig. It's not plain error to use this, to include this as an element. So I'm treating it as an element. I think it means what it says. It's not, was this person have a reasonable apprehension? It's, would a reasonable person in this set of facts and circumstances with the knowledge that the person in the situation has, would they be reasonable to believe that the person is going to act according to the tenor of what they said?
So it's an objective standard with respect to...
It is. And I apologize if I made it seem like I didn't think it was an objective standard. I do think that this is a unique situation. Jurors will never have been a jail deputy, I assume. They wouldn't, they're not in a situation where they deal even with people who are in jail for charges or booking, or why some people get put in some cells and don't get blankets and some people don't and some people do. And all of that is very unfamiliar to them. And also just sort of, what's it like to be in that situation where somebody is really like completely losing it and angry and yelling and screaming at you? But you're also like a deputy. You're sort of, that's part of the job, So that's why I think whether a person in that situation, whether it's reasonable for them to apprehend that they might be killed, they kind of have to look to what the person, they look at that person's subjective response. That's why I think that person's subjective response is relevant. I don't know why else it would be offered as evidence.
So one of the circumstances that, whether it's an objective or subjective apprehension standard, would be the fact that your client 8 months earlier had taken steps and successfully located a county attorney and showed up at that person's house late at night. That's significant, isn't it? That's the Spriegel evidence. Isn't that significant?
It is, and that was how the state argued for admission of that Spriegel incident here. They said specific to Deputy A.S., the deputy in this case, they said that he knew about this, and then when he was interviewed about it, he said, well, yeah, it made me really afraid because I thought he might find out where I live. But that testimony didn't come in at trial. there wasn't any connection made directly to that thought in AS's mind. And so it's not helpful in that way in this trial. It sort of would be dispositive, and it was offered.
But does it go to the issue of maybe intent or your client's ability to carry through with the threat to kill AS?
Well, but I think ability to carry through is relevant to a reasonable apprehension. I mean, if he is serving a life sentence in solitary confinement in a federal prison, and he says, I'm going to kill you, there's no reasonable apprehension. He's never going to get out, and you're never going to go in his cell. That's a ridiculous example, and that's not this case. But I think there are circumstances where it would be unreasonable to apprehend that the person is actually going to kill you. And again, I will say this too, and I just have a little bit of time left. I think that this idea, this whole Spriegel incident, for me, I think it does tie into this idea of the bias and the potential prejudice. I don't know why that incident, where the crime against the Carver County attorney was prosecuted and tried in a different county. And I can understand Mr. Anderson's frustration with every case that he has being tried in Carver County by a Carver County attorney with a Carver County judge, they put in that incident as evidence. To me, that all kind of feeds into this whole big picture of why are we even in Carver County? And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. Just responding to appellant's first argument, and there's been comments about reading the transcript, and I think that's the problem that we have here, trying to look at this on review. We're just reading a bare bones transcript, but we're not listening to it. We're not hearing the how loud these outbursts were. We're not hearing the tone of voice. We're not seeing the outburst. We're not seeing what was going on. And most importantly, we don't know how the jury was reacting. And the judge is right there. He can see how the jury is reacting. Is the jury providing any cues, visual cues, or anything to show that they are taken aback by what's going on here? We don't know any of that here. We're just reading a transcript. And to go back and Monday morning quarterback this judge and say, well, you gave the appearance of impropriety, I don't know that this factual record that we can really make that determination. So that's the first part of my argument, is I don't see that there's a clear appearance of impropriety based on this record. And then that just follows into the remaining part of the analysis, that there's just not the prejudice here that would warrant a new trial.
Well, why shouldn't we be concerned that the jury may have viewed the Spriegel witness, you know, the fact the state rests, and then the court suggests, don't you have another witness? Why shouldn't we be concerned that the jury would see that interaction as some, not that this was the court's witness, but as some, and it's in some way the district court endorsing the importance of that testimony?
Well, again, I think we just go back to the harmless error portion of it, and I note in my brief that once the Spriegel evidence was put into place, and there was a cautionary or limiting instruction provided by the judge on that, I don't believe the state ever mentioned it again. So this wasn't a focal point of the state's case. And this was an involved trial. There were many witnesses, and we had these outbursts that were unavoidable. And the thing that I don't think we can lose sight of is what he's charged with. He's charged with making a terroristic threat. And part of that, the state's case, is the video recording. And you can see, watching that recording, you can see somebody making all these violent movements in his cell. Mr. Anderson took the stand and he testified, and he tried to convince the jury, oh, I was wiping something off on the window. And then when asked about, because there's a camera in there, and the other person in the control center tried to activate that and noted that there was something covering the camera. Turned out, I believe it was Mr. Anderson's shirt. And when asked about that, I think his cryptic response was, I can neither confirm nor deny that that happened. So he's being charged with acting in such a way as to cause somebody to reasonably apprehend a threat, and then we're throwing this on top of the fire. If it's a different case, different charges, maybe there's something different, but I think this judge needed to be on guard that there's a risk of an outburst, and that outburst can only hurt the defendant. I note defense counsel, I think it's, is it in closing or somewhere? It's way after many of these outbursts that he finally tells Mr. Anderson to settle down. Had the judge not done anything, we'd have a different case here. We'd have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And on these facts here, I don't see that there's grounds for this court to reverse and give appellant a new trial.
Mr. Magnuson, on the reasonable apprehension element, how do you respond to opposing counsel that the quantity of Spriegel evidence that actually was admitted, as opposed to what was proffered, was much lower, and that is impacts the sufficiency of the evidence on whether there was a reasonable apprehension?
That's just where I was going to go. I want to point to two portions of the brief. The first one is from my brief on page 10, the first full paragraph. I say the problem with appellant's presence is it conflates inferences juries must draw regarding facts with inferences juries must draw regarding elements of a crime. I read that earlier this week, and I just shook my head. I don't know why I wrote that. What it should say, inferences juries must draw regarding facts with inferences juries must draw regarding legal concepts. And that leads me into this, the second thing I wanted to point the court to. On in the reply brief, on page 2, appellant points out that on the reasonable apprehension element, if AS had testified, quote, anybody in that situation would have thought Anderson was going to carry out the threat, that would have provided evidence of reasonable apprehension. So first one, my part is wrong, but it ties into this part. There are elements that are fact-driven. Was the victim under the age of 13? Did the appellant have knowledge? That's Harris that appellant cites. Did the defendant in that case know that the gun was in the car? But there's legal concepts, as I discuss in my brief, and those are not susceptible to it. And I cite the court to State v. Moore, 699 Northwest 2nd, 733. And that's dealt with great bodily harm, which is a legal concept. And there, the state produced, had the doctor testify that the victim's injuries in that case constituted great bodily harm. And the Supreme Court said that was error. And specifically, and I'm citing on I believe page 740. Expert opinion testimony is not helpful if the subject of the testimony is in the knowledge and experience of a lay jury, and the testimony of the expert will not add precision or depth to the jury's ability to reach conclusions about the subject which is within their experience. Under the helpfulness test, this court has not allowed ultimate conclusion testimony which embraces legal conclusions or terms of art. That's reasonable apprehension. It's not a fact. It's a legal concept. It's an objective, as appellant says, it's an objective standard. That's something that we throw to juries. Yes. Did this occur in Carver County? That's a factual element. Was this a reasonable apprehension? Yes, that's an objective test, and we don't subject that to the circumstantial evidence standard of review. The standard of review, as I quote in my brief out of Loving versus State, and that it's just quoting from a multitude of cases, we will affirm if the jury, giving due regard to the presumption of innocence and the state's burdens, based on the evidence and reasonable inferences drawn from that evidence, could find the defendant guilty. There's not an extra one, could reasonably find the defendant guilty, comma, and no other reasonable alternative inferences can be drawn. So there's a distinction between inferences that are drawn from facts, when that element has to be proven with circumstantial evidence, then we don't defer to the jury. We look at it anew. But when it's a legal concept like this, whether great bodily harm, another one I thought of, DWI test refusal. You have to prove that the law enforcement officer had probable cause to believe that the defendant was under the influence of alcohol or a controlled substance. We don't have a police officer testify, this was probable cause. You lay it out for the jury. This is what the officer observed. And then you ask the jury to find, was this probable cause? It's a legal concept. It's not a fact, and it's not susceptible to the alternative hypothesis theory.
Is there a case that stands for that proposition clearly? I'm not sure that there is.
Not a reported one that I'm aware of.
That specifically says appellate reviewing courts do not apply circumstantial evidence standard of review to legal concepts such as probable cause, reasonable apprehension, great bodily harm.
I'm unaware of any precedential opinion that says that. I cite several cases in my footnote that talk about that. But I think more comes close to it and saying that under the helpfulness test, this court has not allowed ultimate conclusion testimony, which embraces legal conclusions or terms of art. So we defer to the jury on those kinds of questions.
Can I ask you about the sentencing issue? I want to make sure I understand the state's position.
I was just going to get to that.
Okay, I think you agree that the district court erred by adding the 3-month enhancement. What should the sentence be? If we agree with the appellant and you on that point, what should the sentence be?
I've read the sentencing guidelines a couple of times. I don't believe there's anything in there that says you round a criminal history or criminal points down. There's a specific instruction that you round criminal history scores down to the lower number. But I don't recall that there's anything that says you round criminal points down. Having said that, if you look at the grids, they're all whole numbers for the range. And I just did some quick calculation, and every one of them is rounded down. Even if it's 14.4, it's rounded down to 14. 16.8 is rounded down to 16. So I don't think there's a specific instruction in the guidelines that tells district courts that's what they have to do, but that's what the grid does. So I think that's a reasonable interpretation of it, is that it should be 14 months, not 14.4, but not a big worry for the state. I'll leave that to the panel. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you. Just ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Scanlon, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I guess I'll start with the easy one first. Mr. Magnuson is right. It doesn't say that anywhere in the guidelines that you round down. I looked. But yeah, when you do the math in the grids, those are all rounded down. No matter how, it's not even like they round normally. Like if it's above 5, you go up, like, because one of them, like you said, is 16.8. They round that down as well. I guess I'll jump right to the hardest part. I think it's clear that how we actually apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review is currently an issue that parties and the courts are debating. I have a case being on hold with the PFR waiting for FERCUS. But I don't think that more relates to this at all. More is about admissibility of evidence and admissibility of testimony, of expert testimony. Can an expert say, you know, yeah, this was great bodily harm? And so that doesn't mean that we would review the jury's determination about great bodily harm any differently, except that my point is testimony. If something is established directly by testimony, he stole her purse. I saw it. He stole her purse. You don't get circumstantial a review of he stole her purse, because the jury, when the jury found him guilty of stealing her purse, they obviously credited that testimony. That's done. That's not, there's nothing circumstantial about that. There's no inference. Even if there were an inference to be drawn, it doesn't matter. They credited the testimony with direct evidence. If they found her purse in the vehicle that he's known to drive, and that's all they have, well, that's not direct evidence that he stole the purse. You have to infer, well, how else did it get in his vehicle? This is where I think the court, this is, I think, part of the struggle, is that where the court really has some ability to rule on these issues is in the idea of whether the alternative hypothesis is reasonable. Not could it reasonable on the facts of the case. Sure. Just without knowing anything else, you could say, well, maybe her purse got in his vehicle some other way. But if there's nothing in the evidence that suggests some other way that her purse got in his vehicle, that's where instead of the court saying that's not a possible inference to be drawn, the court says instead that inference, though it could be drawn in the abstract, is not reasonable on the facts of this case. And that's where I think some of the confusion is that there are, you know, sometimes they want to jump right to, oh, well, that this is just direct evidence. There's no other hot hypothesis possible. But that's where I think you have to take that step. If an inference was required to prove that element, Harris says very specifically, we defer to the jury's fact-finding, drawing inferences. This is Harris, the Harris case from 2015 or 2016. We defer to jurors' fact-finding. Drawing inferences is not fact-finding. And that's why we don't defer to it, and we have to look at other possible inferences and decide whether any of those that mean innocence are reasonable.
So you don't say in your brief, I don't believe, Mr. Scanlon, what the circumstances proved here were. Can you elaborate on that?
You're right. I didn't articulate them specifically, but I think they're fairly inferred in when I reached that point of talking about, you know, why this particular inference, the inference that it's not, that there isn't reasonable apprehension. I'm talking about specific facts there. I've done it both ways. Certainly in cases before, I've articulated, here are the circumstances proved. And every time I've done that, like, there hasn't been any response. Like, nobody relied on my on my explication. So I think it saves time to say, well, here are the facts that make this inference possible and reasonable. And if I erred in doing that, I apologize.
And the alternative hypothesis that you feel is supported is what?
The alternative hypothesis is that it's not reasonable to think that Mr. Anderson, particularly with respect to the second threat, the threat that I'm going to kill the next person who opens this door, that's not reasonably going to happen because they've heard him say it. And so they're going to prepare themselves. And that's not going to happen. It's not going to be possible in any way for him to come out of that cell when the door opens and start killing people. In a nutshell.
Thank you.
The last thing I was going to say is that, you know, if there was no Spriegel evidence in this case, we probably wouldn't be here.
Thank you, counsel. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion on this matter within the time prescribed by statute.